This is KSQD Santa Cruz, KSQT Prunedale, KSQD 89.5, 89.7, 90.7 FM, or online at ksqd.org. From Santa Cruz, California, I'm Gary Shapiro, and this is From the Bookshelf. Thanks so much for joining me. My guest is Michael Kimmel, and he's an educator and the author of lots of books and articles. His latest book is the absolutely marvelous and rich Playmakers, the Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America. Michael Kimmel, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Well, thanks for having me. Really a pleasure to be with you, Gary.
Loved your book. It was just fantastic. You know, I was really well aware that the movie studios in Hollywood were run by the Jews who brought their Eastern European shtetl experiences to storytelling in the movies. And I was aware that the creators and publishers of comic books, you know, from Superman to the Black Panther, were Jewish. But until I read Playmakers, the Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America, I was unaware that Rock'em Sock'em Robots and G.I. Joe and Mr. Potato Head and Silly Putty were all created by Jews.
Yeah. Me too. I sort of knew the comic book story largely because of, you know, Michael Chabon's amazing novel. And I kind of knew the story of Hollywood because of Neil Gabler's book. And I didn't go looking for this. I think I start the book off by basically saying I thought I was going to write a short family memoir of my great-great-uncle Morris Mictum, who was the founder of the Ideal Toy Company and the creator of the teddy bear. So that was that was what I thought I was going to do. There comes a time, I think, for a lot of writers where you get to a moment where you're at a place where you don't know the answer to things. You don't know where, you know, like I completed the work on the backstory of the teddy bear and the story of the Ideal Toy Company, and that was about it. And I thought, okay, but I don't know anything about the toy industry. I don't know anything about, you know, who else was making toys and what they were doing and where they were getting their ideas from. And so that moment was that kind of moment of truth as a writer. I could end this little family story here and it would be about 120 pages, or I could say, I could try to answer my own question. And that's what I decided to do. And it just sprawled out from there.
Well, I love the fact that you're not afraid to go on tangents. And in fact, the book itself is a tangent, I guess.
It's an enormous one, right?
But so let me ask this question. So I was talking here on From the Bookshelf to Jeremy Dauber. He wrote a book called American Comics, A History. And I asked, you know, why he thought that Jews had dominated both movies and comic books. And he said he thought it was because those industries were considered low class, like the legitimate stage and the comic strip were their higher level counterparts. And it was sort of left, those fields were left for Jews to excel in because the Goyim didn't care about those. But how do you think toys figure into that scenario?
Well, part of the answer, I think he's quite right, especially in terms of the comic books, that a lot of the comic book artists initially wanted to go into advertising, which was in the 30s and 40s, quite a white shoe, very Protestant, anti-Semitic world. And so these guys would go in with their portfolios and the ad agencies would look at them and say, yeah, very impressive. What's your religion? And they, or are you Jewish? And these guys would say, yes. They say, well, we already have our quota of Jews. Sorry. Sometimes that quota was zero, but they didn't get hired. And so they drifted into comic books as a way to be artists in a field that would have them. And so Jeremy Dauber is quite right about that. I think the answer is that plus a couple of other things with the toy industry, particularly around the turn of the 20th century, which is when many of these companies were first founded. The first The first 20 years of the 20th century witnessed a total toy boom in the United States. Prior to 1900, there weren't very many toys. Those that did exist were either handmade, you know, like wooden boat, little carved wooden boats or rag dolls, or imported from Germany. The little metal soldiers that people had, or wooden toys. These were dolls that were, you know, ceramic or porcelain heads that were very fragile, kept on the top of a bookshelf. But around 1900, two trends coincided. One was, and in addition to the anti-Semitism. So, of course, the obstacle is always there. One of them was this wave of Yiddish-speaking Jews from Eastern Europe, not the German Jews of the mid-19th century, who were quite a bit wealthier, middle class, prosperous, and owned and founded many of the department stores that still exist today. And interestingly, of course, later on, provide the entire infrastructure of retail for the toy makers to sell their toys. But the major thing, I think, is that these Yiddish-speaking Jews, when they come to Ellis Island or Castle Garden before that, with their cardboard suitcases tied up with string and a few pennies in their pockets, really poor, off the shtetl, they had a view of childhood that was different than the 19th century model of childhood, and articulated perfectly with that moment, which was the progressivist moment. The progressivism was, after all, a campaign for much longer compulsory schooling, campaigns against child labor. So basically what they were doing was they were creating the infrastructure of a childhood that actually could exist off the farm or out of the factory or out of the coal mines. And so you had the idea of childhood, and now what was going to fill that childhood? And these Jews came with a different idea. If you read the child-rearing manuals of the late 19th century, they'd be kind of shocking to your listeners. They say things like, you know, if your child wakes up in the middle of the night and cries, what you do is you give them a good spanking, and that'll stop them. Or John Watson, who was in the early 20s, the greatest theorist of child development, said that what you should never hug or kiss your child. Never let them sit on your lap, you know, pat them on the head in the evening, greet them with a shake their hand in the morning when you greet them, you know, no, show no affection at all. And these Yiddish speaking Jews come over and they go, no, that's not who we are. We like these new kindergartens. We like these Montessori schools. We think children are, as the Talmud says, a garland of roses. They're a blessing, a nachas. They're wonderful. They're curious. They're creative, and they should be nurtured and encouraged. Suddenly, the question is, what are you going to nourish and encourage them with? And that's where these toy makers all rush in.
Well, the childhood that you're talking about, it didn't just vanish. I mean, I remember. I mean, I was born in 1955, and when I was going to school, there was still quite a bit of corporal punishment. They hit us and spanked us with a paddle, even in, I think I was in junior high school. As a matter of fact, I think I have a lifelong aversion to exercise because my PE teachers were so cruel. They used exercise as a punishment. But nevertheless, I was playing with a lot of toys, and I did, toys did really enrich, not only enrich my childhood, but I think they've enriched my life. I still have all the toys, and they still kind of spark joy, and I'm also interested in new toys. I like toys.
I'm sure that many of the toys that I mentioned in the book were toys that you yourself had and enjoyed.
Yeah,
certainly did. I found, you know, as I was sort of excavating all of this, I basically would say to you, Gary, that my book provides you with the backstory of a lot of the toys that you played with.
And also this idea that this development of the idea of childhood, I find so fascinating. And and the degree to which you believe that Jews played into this or were responsible for it or helped foster it, would you say?
Absolutely. This is what they brought with them. They brought with them this idea, and that childhood was a time not to create value, but was valuable all its own. It was a special time. And you know, all of those notions that became negative stereotypes about Jews, for example, the over-dominant mother yes. in the fantasies of the 1950s, that was originally quite the Balabusta was a very positive idea of mothering, of nurturing children and of encouraging them. It wasn't negative at all.
I remember there was a book called How to Be a Jewish Mother. Oh, you know, there were those books. That was also kind of I can't remember the name of the company that made them, but little books that that fed into that. And I think Charles Schultz's Happiness is a Warm Puppy, those kinds of things. And one of those was How to Be a Jewish Mother. And there was a lot of Jewish mother jokes. And I think Nichols and May fostered a little bit of that. And so, of course, did Philip Roth, right, with Portnoy's Complaint. But that's not such a negative thing, you're saying. I mean, talk a little bit about this division that developed between distinct passages of life, childhood, adolescence, and adulthood.
Well, again, that's, as society is changing, as the demographics are changing, as social life is changing, as the economic world is changing, by which I mean children are there's campaigns against child labor. There's compulsory schooling, which takes children out of the home, out off the farm, out of the factory, into schools. And in 1904, G. Stanley Hall writes this enormous treatise. It's 1,500 pages. It's two volumes. And he said, in between childhood and adulthood, there's a new stage of development, which he called adolescence. And so that idea that childhood or the world of adulthood was now further out of reach. Now it happens by the time you finish high school. It used in 1900, you would say you became an adult when you finished primary school. But now, he says, it extends all the way through high school. And, of course, we've been extending it ever since as kids who are graduating from college are moving back home with their parents.
That's right. You know, 26.
The five demographic markers of adulthood, right, are you finish your education, you move out of your family's home, you get married, you have a kid, and you get a job. Those are the big five. Well, 0% of my students has accomplished all five of those, right? And they're in their early 20s. That idea of adulthood has steadily been expanding. Now, my mother, I should tell you, my mother finished all five of those within 6 months. Hmm. She graduated from college, got engaged to my dad, married my dad. Got her first job in teaching in the New York City public school, got pregnant with me and moved out of her family's house. Right. All in 1948.
Yeah. Well, today people do live a lot longer. I mean, your great great uncle who created the teddy bear died when he was about 68 or something. Right. And he was an old man. And I think you and I are both past that age now, and we still have a long way to go. So that might account for some of the 26-year-olds living at home and having their parents do their laundry, but not all of it, I guess.
It takes longer to launch. The economy is not nearly as welcoming as it once was. There's a lot more, and there's a lot more education to have. It's more difficult to establish that kind of stable economic life by which you can launch a family for most middle-class kids these days. So, yes, it takes longer, and sometimes by choice, you know, like, what's the rush? You know, and I do hear that from you know, younger people, like, wait, your grandparents and great-grandparents, they were all dead by their mid-60s. You know, I'm going to live to my mid-90s. What's the rush?
Yeah. Well, I guess they have a point. Except, you know, the sooner you get going, the better. I would think your life would be, your comfort level.
Right. Well, that's the sort of the American way is it's never a bad time to buy a house because it's always going to be worth more later.
Yeah, right, right. Well, in the filmmakers kind of downplayed their Judaism. They didn't exactly hide it, but they didn't make films except for The Jazz Singer with Jewish themes. And they Louis B. Mayer had a huge nativity scene on his lawn and all that. what about the toy industry? Did they disguise that? I mean, are they called Hasbro so that you won't know they are Jews?
Well, yes and no. Many of them incorporated their Jewishness. The Ideal Toy Company, which is what my great granduncle Morris founded, the Ideal Toy Company was, after all, you know, just a generic name that he liked. It was a very many of these people were clearly assimilationist. Morris named his son Benjamin Franklin Mikdom. You know, like he's making a claim for Americanness here. The Hassenfeld brothers become Hasbro. R&B dolls, F&B dolls are all shortened from obviously Jewish names. Bertha, what was her last name? Becomes Madame Alexander, Bertha. And I think quite a few. So it wasn't quite like Hollywood, where they all changed their names, but there wasn't the kind of, there wasn't a rush to keep it. The good news for the Jews who made the toys was that the entire system was Jewish owned or Jewish controlled. They made the toys. They also were the jobbers who sold the toys, the salesmen who promoted the toys going around the country to the Jewish owned department stores like Bloomingdale's and Gimbel's and, after 5 years, Macy's, FAO Schwartz, you know, Toys R Us, all of these. So the whole industry was Jewish themed. And so they didn't have to have, you know, nativity scenes on their front lawn.
We're talking with Michael Kimmel, and his new book is called Playmakers, The Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America. The filmmakers in Hollywood, the moguls, had all been merchants, and that's what led them to become dream merchants. Is that a similar origin path for toy makers?
No. No, the toy makers were Lower East Side, really poor, but creative. Many of them, had ways of doing their art on like pieces of scrap paper that they would find in the street. Bernie Loomis, who was known as Mr. Saturday Morning, he was the one who created dozens of toys for TV shows. Also, was clever enough and also somewhat shady enough. Let's say he said, you know, instead of advertising on TV, why don't we just make a whole TV show about the toy? And that's the TV show Hot Wheels. Which ended up being closed because it was basically an infomercial instead of disguised as a TV show.
Yeah.
Now Bernie Loomis was Lower East Side, dirt poor, and but he created an entire baseball season based on discarded newspapers with scores in them and batting averages, and he made up this entire league of baseball players. You might think of him as the first fantasy baseball player, so they found whatever materials they had at hand. They were enormously creative and looking, you know, in a way, Gary, I think that the comic books, the Hollywood, the toy industry, some of the comic strips that I talk about there, it's an assimilationist story. Some of the assimilationist story is, of course, hide your Jewishness. And some is, you know, just live with it like any other American lives with a hyphen. And just accept it. And I think that the key is These people were looking for a way to fit in. When one is marginal, when one experiences discrimination of any kind, racism, anti-Semitism, homophobia, whatever, you develop what W.E.B. Du Bois called a double consciousness. You see yourself when you're with your people, and then you see yourself as others see you. And that double consciousness is what you're always negotiating, what you're always having to navigate.
Right. I mean, you can decide that Judaism is not important to you, but people still see you as a Jew.
Right. And there's a distinction I think that American Jews have made for a long time between Judaism and Jewishness. Right. Mm-hmm. One can be clearly Jewish and quite secular.
Right. Right. Where I guess you can't be a secular Christian.
Well, yeah. I suppose you can. You could be a C&E Christian. Right. I think the notion that one can be culturally a Jew without being religiously Jewish is a distinction that some people might think it's a distinction without a difference. But, you know, are Jews a religion or a culture? You know, are they one or the other? Yes.
Well, I had a toy. It was called the Vacuform. It was made by Mattel. And it was a thing that heated up, and then you would put a piece of plastic in it, and you had a mold, and you could make a little car or a plane with this thing. And it was dangerous. I never hurt myself on it unless I played with it, in which case I would terribly burn part of me, or I would also inhale the burning
the fumes
plastic.
Of the
plastic. At what point were there safeguards put in place about toys, and how did the playmakers deal with those things?
Well, there were whole Senate hearings about toy safety in the mid 1950s. In addition to the Vacuform, which eventually, I remember them being in like an arcade where it was quite a bit bigger Vacuform, but you didn't touch it; it was behind glass, and it made you like a plastic dinosaur.
Thing. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah.
I have some.
The campaigns were about the ways in which different kinds of toys were harmful. And the two that were, one was that in the Easy Bake Oven, they yeah. use an actual light bulb
right.
to bake the cake, as it were, in this toy oven, and the light bulb would get hot. So
otherwise,
that could possibly burn kids.
Yeah.
But these single caught, you know, unlike today, where the single greatest cause of death of children is firearms,
mm-hmm.
in the 1950s, the single greatest, one of the greatest causes of death in children was swallowing small objects. Think of a Lego or a jack, those kinds of things where children would swallow things. So they had to, there were all kinds of hearings about how to label them, how to make sure that some toys could only be sold with adult supervision. Because the big problem at the time, and all of this comes because after 1955, when the Mickey Mouse Club goes on the air, the entire toy industry promotion shifts. Earlier, toys were advertised in Parents Magazine. Parents Magazine was also founded by first-generation Jews. And it was the single greatest, it was the only magazine that increased its circulation during the Depression. It was the most one of the most popular magazines in America. You advertised in parents' magazines, and then suddenly, starting in 1955, you could advertise directly to children. They were your salesmen. You advertised to them. That you created the desire. Then they went to their parents and say, "I want this toy." So that's what spurred the hearings. Was the kids are wanting these toys? They look awesome, and then they would play with them by themselves. And they needed adult supervision. They needed adults to help them figure out how to, you know, glue the plastic airplane together, how to play with the small with the small pieces and not swallow them. And that was a really big issue.
I used to make Aurora monster models. That was my thing. I was gratified
again,
to hear
Aurora, first generation Jew, Revell, Renwall, Remco, all of them.
Yeah, I would. I had this, you know, airplane glue that was. It would make the plastic stick anywhere but to where you wanted it to stick. And then it would kind of melt the plastic, and, you know, the thing was very difficult to make, and I would be so high from the airplane glue that, yeah, who cared? But
and then you'd have to take the – then you'd have to soak the decal in water and then take it off the paper just so you could put it on the wing of the plane.
Yes. I spent many hours with this. And I mean, I think that airplane glue, after a while, they wouldn't sell it to you. I think they stopped That's making right. it. They don't even make it the way they used to anymore.
No, I think it's probably now all Elmer's glue, the white glue.
I guess school glue. Legos are great for that because they don't require any gluing. They somehow mm-hmm. stick together. But when you were talking about the television and the commercials, I mean, I remember a lot of toy commercials that enchanted me, which is why I bought a G.I. Joe, fighting man from head to toe. And I remember all of those, you know, in fact, first time I saw a Barbie doll, I have to say, I said to myself, this is a toy for girls?
Well, you know the backstory of Barbie, right? I mean, to have you, a boy, say this is a toy for girls is exactly what Barbie was based on, was a toy for men in Germany. And it wasn't like it wasn't a sex toy. It was a sexy toy.
Yeah.
And they, you know, and the model for Barbie was Bill Lilly, who was a comic strip character who was quite sexy and sassy in the comics. And she was so popular that they made a doll. And that's what Ruth Handler saw when she was on vacation and said, we can make a doll of this. And everybody thought, oh, no, you couldn't possibly do that. That would be really, you know, way too risque.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that way she wouldn't look at you, Barbie. You know, she's looking somewhere else. Her eyes are over here.
Right. but I think, you know, the G.I. Joe, though, has a good backstory. You know, my family, my great-great-uncle had founded the Ideal Toy Company. And initially, the G.I. Joe doll was created by someone who was a toy designer at Ideal. And he came to the CEO and said, I have this idea for an action figure. We can't call it a doll, but an action figure for boys. And it would be this scale and it would look like this. It would be a soldier. And Ideal just said, that's the stupidest idea ever. Boys won't play with the doll. And so he said, okay, all right. Do you mind if I take it somewhere else? And he took it to Hasbro and they bought it. And it's been a gazillion seller ever since.
A bad decision there.
Oh, they made several. They 2 years before Barbie, the Ideal was toying. Sorry for the verb. Was toying with the idea of a Marilyn Monroe doll.
Oh, that would have
been. Which they also rejected because, you know, girls want to be mothers, so they said. So they rejected that. And their biggest mistake was they saw all these people, you know, these Christians at Christmas time going and looking at all these nativity scenes. And so Ben Mikdum, the CEO, got the idea of a baby Jesus doll. He thought this is really going to just clean up. And so he goes to the Vatican and he meets with the Pope and makes a substantial contribution to the Vatican. And the Pope gives him his blessing. You can go make a baby Jesus doll. So they package the baby Jesus doll in straw, in a crate, in a manger, with all kinds of Bible verses around it, and nobody bought it. Absolutely not a chance. You know, parents were horrified with the idea that their kid is going to pick Jesus up and carry him around like a baby. Not going to happen. So it was a complete failure.
I love the picture in your book, Michael Kimmel, in your book, Playmakers, the Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America, of the Pope sanctioning the making of this, as if the Pope somehow had the rights to Jesus. They gave him a...
Exactly, a wholly owned subsidiary.
when I was a kid, they also advertised a lot of cereal on Saturday morning. So Saturday morning was the... I think that was anti-Semitic, actually, the fact that Saturday morning was the time for kids, because that's also the time for Saturday school. We had to go to Hebrew school. We didn't get to watch all those Saturday morning shows. But You couldn't tell the cartoons from the commercials. Jay Ward made both the cartoons and the Captain Crunch commercials, which were hilarious. And they have a definitely kind of a Jewish feel to them. I mean, Captain Crunch.
A lot of them. Half the voices that you were hearing in those cartoons were Mel Blanc, and Elmer Fudd and Daffy Duck and Bugs Bunny, of course. And including June Foray, who was the first voice of the Chatty Cathy doll. You remember that doll where you pull the string and she says, you know, I hurt myself or I love you. She also was the voice of Rocky, of Natasha, of Betty Rubble. She was amazing numbers of Jewish performers were also, you know, sort of animating all of these. And Jay Ward, of course, the creator of Rocky and Bullwinkle, and Shari Lewis, the creator of Lamb Chop.
Oh yeah, you mentioned Pinky Lee in your book.
Pinky Lee, yeah.
He was Jewish as well.
Yeah, Pincus Leff.
Oh, you make me so mad.
That's right. And also Soupy Sales, who had two separate lives. One when we were little kids and we watched him because he was so zany and goofy. And then later when I was in high school, we sort of rediscovered him with a kind of, you know, adolescent irony. Like it became this kind of fun thing to like something that was so retro.
Yes. And he had all kinds of famous guests on his show that would all get hit with pies. he famously told children to send him
the little green pieces of paper in their parents' wallets.
it's fascinating. Your book expands into talking about the comic book industry quite a bit. And how do comics and Pinky Lee and Sherry Lewis tie into toy makers?
Well, the way the book evolved, I started looking initially like, where did all these toy makers by the 20s and 30s, where did they get their ideas for toys? And I looked, for example, at comic strips like Joe Palooka, drawn by Ham Fisher, and Ideal Toy Company licensed Joe Palooka's image to make all kinds of toys and action figures. And in fact, had a contract with Ham Fisher that if Joe Palooka got married and had a child, they, Ideal, would be able to manufacture him, So I was into the world of comic books and comic strips. The most famous comics are probably the most famous comic strip of the century, at least prior to Peanuts, was Lil Abner. Lil Abner was drawn by Al Capp, who never set foot in the South. Dog Patch really is the shtetl in Appalachia. You know, it's Mammy and Pappy Yoakum, Abner and Sally Mae, you know, so all of these became toys. All of these became, you know, tie-ins. And then of course, comic books, was basically an entirely Jewish industry from the creators to the distributors, and all of them, I mean, Stan Lee and the Marvel Universe, Siegel and Schuster, creators of Superman, virtually all of them. And many of them had very similar kinds of backstories. You know, it's said that DeWitt Clinton High School in the Bronx was called Comic Book High because several of the major comic book artists all went to the same high school, graduated around the same time. So there was a lot of ferment at the time. So I talk about comic books. Then, as I'm discussing this, as I'm sort of trying to map this field, the New York Public Library put out a list of the 100 most important children's books of the 20th century.
Right.
And of those 100 most important children's books, 42 of them were written by first-generation Jews. including many of the ones that I had read or had read to me as a child. Curious George, Caps for Sale, All in One Family, and of course Where the Wild Things Are, and Ezra Jack Keats's book Snowy Day. These are books that were read to me, so I kind of like the idea that this is that you know, Curious George has a whole Jewish backstory to it. The Rays, who were living in Paris, had drawn this monkey as a cartoon character, and they're living in Paris. And in June 1940, as the Germans are coming from the north and east through Belgium down into Paris, the Rays got a bicycle and went south and west across France, across Spain, all the way to Portugal, where they sailed to the U.S. with a cartoon character who they named Fifi. And when they got here and found a publisher, the editor said, "I don't think Fifi's going to work here. I think what we really need is a different cartoon character name." And that's how Curious George was born.
And so they changed their names as well.
But yes, right, from Reiersbach to Ray. So, you know, there's a lot of these backstories. There's a lot of these wonderful stories. And one of the things that sort of capped it off for me was, as the fields of developmental psychology, of child psychology, are developing, the premier child psychologists of the 20th century were also all these first-generation Jews. And let me be clear that when I say first-generation, what I'm meaning is the first generation born here in the United States, not necessarily immigrants, but the first ones born here, many born quite poor. So I'm thinking of Yuri Bronfenbrenner and Chaim Ganat and Eric Erickson and Abraham Maslow and Lawrence Kohlberg and Carol Gilligan. All of the major theorists of childhood were themselves first generation Jews. You know, and I mean, Eric Erickson, the king of developmental psychology of child development. I mean, he was his real name was not Eric Erickson. He did not give birth to himself. His real name was Eric Homburger. But he was ashamed and chose instead to be what I would think of as a self-made man. Eric, son of Eric.
Eric Erickson. Well, the blacklist in Hollywood and the comic book scandals, I believed that they were rooted in anti-Semitism, and your book discusses that as well.
Absolutely. So the blacklist affects a lot of actors in Hollywood, of course, and a lot of writers. Many of us know those stories from, you know, various stories about them, about, for example, Dalton Trumbo, the Woody Allen Zero Mostel movie, The Front. So we know something about that. There was also a campaign to root out communists during the McCarthy era, from the New York City public schools. Well over 100 New York City public school teachers were fired because of they would not renounce their communist ties or were suspected of being communist. And one of them, in fact, Irving Adler, who was a science teacher, refused to renounce his membership in the party. When he was fired, he became a children's book writer. He was a science teacher. He wrote those books like Why Is There Air? What is Fire? And they were amazing successes for children. I remember reading some of them when I was a kid. It showed me in a way that, you know, that phrase, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. These first generation Jews were the ultimate lemonade makers. You know, hit them with anti-Semitism and they're going to figure out a way to deal with it. You want to exclude us from your country club? Okay, we'll found our own.
You mentioned that some of the other founders of childhood in America, the shapers of it, Dr. Seuss, Walt Disney, I think you mentioned Charles Schultz, those guys are not Jews.
And Ben Spock.
And Spock, Benjamin Spock. Yeah. I was surprised that Benjamin Spock is not Jewish, because Leonard Nimoy is Jewish, and he's Mr. Spock. but you're saying that although they were not Jews, they showed an influence, or you say it. I can't quite figure out what you're saying.
What I'm trying to say is, of course, let's acknowledge that Jews it wasn't a monopoly, but Jews were dramatically overrepresented in these fields of child development. So yes, Benjamin Spock, who was a upper class Dutch reformed, had actually been a rower for the U.S. in the 1928 Olympics. Mm. He was and had gone to Yale, as had his father. Spock was, basically was part of that same genre of children are creative, curious, and basically spent time, as did many of these, parents' magazines, and several of the Jewish advice columnists, like Dear Abby and Ann Landers, who were twin sisters, both Jewish. So he basically was reassuring parents, you're doing okay. Don't be anxious about this. Unless you drop them on their heads from a fairly high distance, you will not break them. They're okay. You're doing fine. And very reassuring. But so what I'm trying to say is we didn't have a complete monopoly, but we were overrepresented. Here's an interesting little factoid, though. Ted Geisel, who Dr. Seuss. Now, Dr. Seuss, there's quite a few little Jewishy references in some of his earliest books, particularly like the Sneetches. But Ted Geisel was an undergraduate at Dartmouth and was not Jewish, but he wanted to pledge this fraternity, and they rejected him because they thought he was. Similarly, he then went to another fraternity and they rejected him, also thinking he was Jewish, and he was not, but somewhat like Charlie Chaplin, he did not disavow it. Mm. He didn't say, no, I hate those Jews just as much as you do. He didn't do that. And so he never got into a fraternity. And was from what I can gather from biographies, relatively unhappy at Dartmouth. But he created, he created a world of funny sounds, of funny names. And I think in many respects, he sort of channeled some of that what he didn't disavow, the way that Charlie Chaplin did, I think.
That cartoon, Gerald McBoing Boing, that Dr. Seuss wrote, it seems like a very Jewish kind of cartoon to me. We're chatting with Michael Kimmel, and his book is called Playmakers, The Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America. And as you can tell from our discussion, the book also encompasses so much more than just toys. I don't mean to say just toys, like toys aren't incredibly great, but but the big question, so there are, 3.5 billion Christians and 3 billion Muslims and a billion Sikhs or whatever. And then you get down to the very bottom of
the inverted pyramid.
The inverted pyramid. And you have 14 million Jews, very small number of Jews with an outsized influence, not only in American popular culture, but as you're pointing out in child rearing. And of course, in science and Albert Einstein and Oppenheimer and so many other. Why this outsized influence in the world, do you think?
Well, the question of why I think Jews created what I call the material culture of childhood, the things we played with, the things we read, the things we thought about, the things that we did. I think some part of it has to do with the confluence of the where, the when, and the why, what these Jews brought with them, the world that they encountered in 1900 when they arrived here, the ideas of progressivism, which were already taking shape, which they themselves already shared. So I think that there's the outside influence in the world of children, is there was a niche there that nobody knew needed to be filled. because it was just being invented as these Jews arrived. I don't think there's, I do think that there is, look, you know, there's a kind of, there's a difference between traditional ideas about Judaism and the ways in which Christianity was spread. The notion that they, that Jews must be literate, that, you know, the reading of the Talmud is like what every Jewish boy is supposed to do. Morris Michtam, my great-great uncle, who created the teddy bear and founded the Ideal Toy Company, he was studying to be a rabbi. But so was everybody else. I mean, it's what you did. And in a way, if you think about the great reform of the Second Vatican Council in the 1950s was, let's do the mass in the language that people actually speak. They don't have to, you know, let's not do the mass facing away from the congregation. Let's involve them. Let's let them read the text themselves. Now, Protestants were very involved in this, of course, because the Book of Common Prayer obviously assumed the literate public. But Catholicism did not. Catholicism, you know, we'll do it for you. You just sit there and nod, okay, and you know, do all the physical things, but you don't have to read it. So it does seem to me that Judaism, of all the monotheistic religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism, of all the monotheistic religions, Judaism places a premium on literacy. And of course, that pushes them. And also, being marginal, one always looks to the margins for the cultural trends, for the cultural innovators. Those who are comfortable in the center don't need to move very much. So, for example, we used to say this about fashion, for example. If you want to know what suburban white boys are going to be wearing in 3 years, look at what urban black boys and gay men are wearing now.
Right.
Because that's what trends move from the margin to the center. The innovators are always on the margins. Jews are in many ways, somebody once wrote, Jews are always the visiting team. They're never the home team. You know, Theodor Adorno, the great sociologist of the Frankfurt School, said imagination is the only true homeland of the Jews. And I always thought that that captures something about that, you know, being marginal means you have to innovate. You have to constantly be creating. So I think in a way, their marginalization actually helps them in that sense. I don't think there's any special gene. I don't think we have the Nobel Prize for Physics gene. But I do think I do think the experience of marginality means we have to look for places where we can innovate in order to fit in. The project is fitting in. The project is assimilation. Everybody, let me put it this way. If you ask an adolescent, they don't want to just fit in. They want to stand out. But the one thing they don't want to do is to stick out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And so you've got to figure out a way to be outstanding but not stick out.
Well, this thing you were saying just a minute ago about how the Catholics interpreted for their mass, and that kind of reminds me of the comic book scandal, because the comic book writers, like Gaines at EC Comics, for instance, he believed that the people reading his comics were smart, and therefore he could tell them stories that were funny or scary or gross or whatever they were, because he knew that they were smart enough to know they were being told an interesting story. The people who condemned comic books thought that the comic book readers were idiots and would see, oh, here's a guy's chopping a woman's head off, let's go do that.
Right.
The Jews gave their readers more credit than
maybe so. The great comic book scare of the time in the 1950s, the big scare, remember that in the 1950s, social science and psychology were preoccupied with two things that were problems for young boys, particularly. One was juvenile delinquency, and one was homosexuality. And the country was terrified that, you know, whether it was a Rebel Without a Cause and James Dean sort of like, you know, being a juvenile delinquent was so scary. Both homosexuality and juvenile delinquency were thought to be caused by the same thing.
The one with Marlon Brando combined them both
homosexual. Overdominant mother and absent father.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So the project was get boys away from the feminizing clutches of mother and teacher and get, you know, books by like Philip Wiley, about these unbelievably clutching mothers and smothering, not mothering. And then I think that fear was that comic books, not unlike Professor Harold Hill's billiard parlor and his Music Man town orchestra or boys band, the idea was that you had to find a way to combat these evils. And they began to read comic books as if they believed that people read comic books as if they were how-to manuals.
Right.
I don't know. I felt like we had the capacity for fantasy and we know the difference. I mean, look, Gary, how many murders have you witnessed on TV shows? And do you think you've become numb to them? If you actually saw one now, would you feel nothing? Because, well, it's just ketchup. No. We know the difference between reality and fantasy. We live it every single day. You see a real car crash. How many? You've seen 10,000 car crashes. You still feel something. Why? Because it's real and you know it. So I feel like some of these fantasies that children and the guy who was the major theorist against these comic books, Frederick Wertheim, also a first generation Jew, he thought that Batman and Robin promoted homosexuality. And that was really dangerous. They had to get rid of that one.
Yeah, that's right. Well, why is a man running around in his underwear with a 12-year-old boy who's running around in his underwear?
Right.
Well, but I mean, it is amazing that these Jews enriched our lives with some incredible inventions and developments like, you know, fake vomit.
Right.
What would our lives be like? There was a trick shop at the farmers market in Los Angeles where they used to sell all these little novelties. And your book tells me Jews thought of all of those, too.
A large number of them were in fact, created by first-generation Jews. Irving Fishlove was in Chicago, was the creator of, you know, the fake dog poop, the fake ants, the fake vomit. And one of it. And then he created all these little, like boxes that seemed to be about something that were ultimately like sexist and gross, like it was a box that had a picture of a car with a flat tire on it, and then and it said flats fixed, and when you opened it up it was falsies. And it's constantly this thing, and you know this tradition, the brilliance. Irving Fishlove once created a fake urinal. Think about how you know, just how gross this was. He created a fake urinal that had no plumbing to it. He attached it to a wall in the men's room at Wrigley Field in Chicago. And then he hid in one of the toilet stalls to watch men use it and then realize that it wasn't flushing. It was splashing back at them or whatever. So you have to ask yourself this question about, like, what is it? I mean, I suppose that other really great theorists of Jewish humor, like Jeremy Dauber, who's been on your show. I mean, you have to ask yourself both the genius and the puerility both at the same time. Like who else but Mel Brooks could come up with something so brilliant as Blazing Saddles with, you know, the black sheriff in town and just evoke all of those racist stereotypes and make fun of them, and then have these cowboys sitting around a bonfire farting for 10 minutes, right? I mean, it's brilliant and then really puerile and gross.
Yeah, juvenile. Yeah, and embracing it, I guess, you know.
Absolutely. And embracing both. That's, I think that there's a certain genius there.
Well, it's part of adolescence, isn't it? To and I guess
gross out humor. Yeah.
Well,
and Mad Magazine, of course, was I mean, it sold millions of copies, but it was so Jewish. Like every, you know, constantly Alfred E. Newman, you know, oh, they spelled it with a U. It's not really Jewish, yeah. But was constantly coming up with all these Yiddishisms in the comic, and just absolutely as if it were normal.
Yeah, a lot of Yiddish words moved into our vocabulary, I think, because they were in that Verschugene magazine. That... well, your book, Playmakers, the Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America, Michael Kimmel, it's rich and it's layered. And when I got to the end, I was depressed. I wanted it to go on for a couple hundred more pages. You think you could write Playmakers 2 for us?
Well, you know, it's an interesting thing when you said when it ends, because I struggled with how to end this book. When do I end it? Do I bring it into video games? Do I keep going? And I decided to end it with the first episode of Sesame Street. And the reason that I did was, A, Sesame Street had been the brainchild of a first-generation Jewish woman. But secondly, they had convened a panel of experts in order to sort of think about whether they should be educational or entertaining or both and how to do it. But if you think about the set of Sesame Street, it's not a suburban lawn with a white picket fence and lots of happy kids playing in the suburbs. It's basically a tenement in the Lower East Side. You got a character who lives in a garbage can. You got laundry hanging over, you know, laundry drying in between the apartments. And basically, I felt like, okay, we've started. The arc is complete. We're back in the Lower East Side again. And so that's why I decided to end it there. But yes, it left me wanting more also.
Well, I hope there'll be more. And when there is more, maybe you'll come back and talk to us again. Michael Kimmel, the book is called Playmakers, the Jewish Entrepreneurs Who Created the Toy Industry in America. Thank you so much for joining us on From the Bookshelf. Appreciate it.
Really appreciate it. Thanks, Gary.
That's it for this week's From the Bookshelf. I hope you enjoyed the program and will come back and see us again next time. In the meantime, you can check out our website at fromthebookshelf.com. You can subscribe to our podcast wherever you subscribe to podcasts. You can even get your smart speaker to play From the Bookshelf by saying, Alexa, play Gary Shapiro's From the Bookshelf. And she will. Until next time, for From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. Take care. See you soon.